Oh yeah, sure, yeah.
There we go.
Yeah, easy.
So the thing is, I'm going to start this from scratch right now because I'm talking bollocks already. So I've got a really, really nice man with me for today's episode who I met in Mallorca, and we just got on very, very well. Nico Roach, not the cyclist, the runner. The runner has been mistaken for the cyclist, though. No denying that one. Rides like a goat. And I'm going to say you are just a goat, basically. You're the goat in terms of athleticness. But we had a great time in Mallorca. And we were just chatting before I started recording about me being in Spain and post-holiday blues. Yes and no. I'd say yes and no because I've been so busy since I got back. I got back on Monday afternoon and my partner had to go to London, literally 2 hours. Are you drinking a beer? Oh, no, it's tea.
Yeah, classic.
Oh, it's because you're in Germany. So my partner had to go to London literally from 2 hours after I got back because for some work stuff. And then her sister is very, very heavily pregnant and is probably having a baby today or tomorrow, shall we say. So things have been manic on that sense. And it's just the thing with any kind of trip. Like, I think anyone will know what it's like. You just end up playing catch up with everything for a few days. And I think I pretty much texted you when I was flying home, or it was the day I was traveling back home anyway. I was like, mate, let's just do a podcast and talk crap for an hour or so.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, cool. And that's normally how these podcasts go. It's a text message to someone and I'm like, do you know what? It'd be really good to do this. Let's just talk rubbish for an hour or so. And then, that's kind of the way it is. But a funny thing for me is that when I first met you, I thought you were German before you spoke.
It's just me, right? Do I generally look angry or strict? Is that maybe... It's a first if I give off those vibes.
No, so
let's hear it. What's the background there?
The background is... So we went out to Mallorca. It was a group of us organized by a good friend, Ollie. And I said to Ollie, who have you got coming? And he was like, oh, Lawrence is coming, Liam's coming, myself, Ollie, and some mates from Germany. So obviously my mind goes, if they're from Germany, they've got to be German. I think that's a pretty good assumption to make.
Sure.
And so Lawrence... I rented a car and I waited for Lawrence at the airport because we were getting a flight within like, I don't know, an hour of each other or something. And we were continually referring to yourself, Cass and everyone as the Germans. And not thinking anything about it, turned up and a bunch of Americans rock up.
Yeah.
And we were like, we've really got that assumption wrong.
Yeah, we actually are all totally German. We just watch American TV since when we were born, and so we've got great American accents. No, yeah, that's totally fair to make that. I remember, watching Lawrence's videos, his vlogs, if you will, on his channel afterwards, and yeah, you're driving, and he was like, yeah, we're gonna go meet the Germans.
Yeah.
And then I remember like we rocked up, I was sitting on my bike and I think it panned to you or Liam. And I want to say, not to make this up, but I'm pretty certain that he captured the moment that one of you two had heard me speak for the first time. And it was kind of like, oh, that's not a German accent. Okay. All right. But yeah, nevertheless.
It was a good situation to be in. It's, you know, always expect the unexpected and all that crap. And I think we were all just a bit like, oh, okay. But my doorbell's going. 1 second.
Easy. Yeah.
It'll be the
reminder that life happens.
Yeah.
Life happens, everyone. You can't pause the postman.
My guess to what that is very unknown. It's a big, black, long plastic thing. Not addressed to me, addressed to my partner. And I just looked at it and I was, the guy was like, oh, is this number 18? I was like, yeah, yeah. And he just handed me this thing. It's just fragile on it. And it's like, yay big.
Oh.
And I was like, cool. Don't know what she's been ordering while I've been away, but there's something.
Yeah. The old fling a text over. Hey, you have a package. I don't really know what this is, but I've accepted it. All good. It's here. It's fine. Yeah. It'll be here when you get back.
There's several there. I mean, we're both as bad as each other. While I've been away, tons of stuff turned up. While she's been away, tons of stuff has turned up for her. So it's like, yeah, swings and roundabouts. But anyway, yeah, Mallorca, we went out there and did not expect, you know, as we've already just sort of covered, didn't expect to be riding with a bunch of very lovely Americans and two Brits.
Yeah, Kate and Neil.
Who are, you know, genuinely, I would personally say, one of the things that I love about cycling is it becomes a very easy way to connect to people because you just chat bollocks. And it, you know, I personally feel like made some really good friends out of that trip. It was a fantastic trip.
Yeah.
It was challenging at points, let's say, the day that it absolutely hammered it down. But yeah.
Yeah, I rode with Neil on Sunday.
Yeah.
Sunday, this past Sunday. And he, we were talking about it. And because it was just crazy windy. It's crazy windy this time of the year in Nuremberg, Germany, where we live. Mm. And you just get up on these, like, even just the tiniest, you gain, I don't know, 400 meters over the course of the ride. But you just get up to these sections and you crest up and you're just completely exposed.
Yeah.
And you just get, like, blown over. So we end up just shouting at each other over the course of 50K. And I'm like, I'm pretty, like, if anyone's walking on this road, they probably can hear us from a half mile away.
Yeah.
But anyways, yeah, we were talking about that ride, and that was like day two, I think, or day, like the second ride or the third ride, the third ride.
It's the third ride,
I believe. And I remember at one point, Neil and I, well, many points throughout the trip, we found ourselves just back of the line being like, this is great. Don't have to do anything. You got Chris and Ollie just putting it down up front. This is great. But we found each other, and it was when we were just hauling it on that highway.
Yeah.
Back, and he just looked at me, and it was one of those things where there was no communication. He did end up saying something, which I'll say in a second, but you just had a mutual understanding of the situation that you had just been through, kind of, you know. It's like, we have seen this was, and he just turns to me and he goes, mate, this isn't the one. I was like, oh no. I was like, do you need, I have a gel, like, are you okay? And he's like, no, I'm fine, but like, this is horrible. And I was like, oh no. But then it was fine. It cleared up shortly after that. I remember for like maybe the last 5-10K of the ride.
Yeah,
you were the only one that had gloves. You had proper overshoes.
Yep.
And we debated going out there. You remember when we like peeled off because Lawrence had his camera and he was like, I really don't want to get stuck in this.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that was a nuts one.
It was. So we, the ride itself, we were, I can't remember where we were staying, but we went up to I have many funny stories about that particular climb. We rode up to the petrol station climb. I did not realize, first of all, the petrol station is now actually closed. It's still there, but it's no longer open as a petrol station. And everyone will know in Mallorca that climb as the petrol station climb. And you can, when you get to the top of it, you can take a right turn and you've got an amazing descent. Or you do what we do, where we rode up it and then descended straight back down the same way that we rode up, which we climbed it, like the famous way of climbing that route. You got the cafe at the top. We got to the, like, as we were riding up, the weather was pretty biblical. I thought the weather was going to be a bit crap that day anyway. That's why I had gloves on me and I put overshoes on. And but I didn't have overshoes. I had toe covers.
Yes, same.
But yeah. I had my legs out. I think all of us had our legs out.
Yeah.
And I took in a bar bag a set of gloves and a rain jacket. And that was it. And we got to the top. We went into the cafe, sat in the cafe. Everyone had a coffee. I think we bought some cafe bonbons, and it was people's first cafe bonbons. Yeah. Which, if you've not had a cafe bonbon, it's a proper Spanish thing. It's espresso and condensed milk, and it's like rocket fuel. We sat there and tried to psych ourselves up for going on the bike again. No one was particularly motivated. And I then went out to the petrol station and got some of the petrol pump gloves, which I put on between my other gloves so that it was like a dry layer. It actually worked quite well, to be fair.
Yeah.
But I made sure I put my gloves back over the top so I could grip on the handlebars again. And then we would all just like, fuck it. We've got to get back. There's not really much of a choice here. It's down the hill and deal with the cold. And that is the fastest. Oh no, my dog's knocked his toy out. That's the fastest I've ever gone down that descent in that weather.
Yeah.
Like, I'm surprised we didn't have a crash or anything. Like, we were nailing it down there. For me personally, I'm a much more confident descender if I follow the line of someone else. It just works much better for me. Mm-hmm. And I know that Lawrence and Ollie, and we're just going to absolutely hammer it down there. So I was like, cool, I'm going to watch where they go. The last, like, I think Lawrence just rode off, didn't he? He got to the bottom.
Yeah, he just stormed off.
He's like, I'm not doing this anymore, I'm going. And then the rest of us rode together. And it did start to warm up and dry out. But I remember the next day, I think we all did nothing because we all felt a bit shit.
We actually got like sick, which to the everyone watching, listening, it, to our understanding, none of us had COVID. It was just, you know, a refresher that you can actually get a cold still, you know, in the last 2.5 years, you can still get a cold.
Yeah.
And we all woke up like, man, we are sluggish. I was like, my body is just, I've been tensed like this for an hour and a half yesterday.
Yeah.
Everything trying to like get warm.
And the weather the next day wasn't great either. So I think all of us are just like,
no,
yeah, that's a good enough excuse not to bother riding. So just didn't. But it was an amazing trip. And, you know, for me, it was a real, like, I'd always said that trip for me was like a start of me training again. You went and absolutely smashed it up Sacalabra. Not necessarily getting the time you wanted, but it was fucking impressive time still. I was impressed. But the thing is, young Nick, I can say that because I also learned I was the oldest on that trip.
Which,
mate, that hurt. That got
when I realized that there were people that were like 7 years younger than me or like 6 years younger than me. I was like, oh, Ollie, you're like 24. What?
Yeah.
You're younger than my little brother who I knew as a child. Oh, it's like one of my good friends. And I was like, oh, no.
Yeah.
What?
Hey. It only dawned on me that I was the eldest. But I'm not, you know, I'm 32. I'm not considered the eldest. But it dawned on me because I think Ollie or Lawrence, someone kept rubbing it in. And I was like, oh, yeah, it's Ollie. And I was like, you're taking the piss out of the old man again. You don't want to do that.
Here's the thing, Chris. It's always the youngest person on the trip that does that.
Yeah.
You know, because like I'm closer to you than I am to Ollie in age.
Yeah.
I also thought if Liam had told me he was 18 years old, I'd be like, yeah, sure. When I found out he was the same age as me,
yeah.
I was like, whoa, what? Like, nah, there's no way.
Liam's very baby-faced. I mean, this is the
nicest way, Liam. Yeah. But like, yeah, exactly. I was like, dude, you could have just like, you could tell me like you crammed in this trip right after finals at uni or something. I don't know. You know, like I would have been like, oh yeah, sure. Makes sense.
You could believe it. But yeah, I mean the reference of, you know, yourself, you have a very good sporting background. Let's not deny that.
Something like that.
You're quite good at running.
It's all relative, I guess. Yeah, compared to most people. Here's the thing to everyone. Chris had texted me about some things. He was like, hey, what do you want to talk about? And he's like, you're running and how you got into cycling. And then we'll talk whatever outside of that. And I was like, great. And I feel like it's all relative. my approach to running, in particular my history with running, is very similar to your approach with cycling and your history with cycling. And what I mean by that is, like, neither of us, you're not sitting there like shouting at the top of your lungs your accolades or things that you've done. And I would never do that with running, because it's not, it doesn't define me what I've, like, you know, what I've run. Sure, I've run some fast times, run some good results, but it's like, so there's always a faster person on this earth.
Unless you're using Bolt over 100 meters.
Yes. I don't think anyone will ever run faster than that individual. But yeah, a sport background in running. Transitioned to cycling when I moved to Germany, a little bit before that. And love cycling. Still love running. My body hurts. Run a lot, Chris, in my lifetime. At some point, you just say, hey, maybe, you know, I'd like to walk when I'm 50. And 50 is not old by any means. But I know a lot of people that have done the career trajectory that I was on, and like, they're 45, 50, and they look stiff. And like, as weird as that is to describe an individual,
yeah,
it's like, oh, like, your knees are kind of weird now. A lot of pounding on the body. So
I mean, anyway, running at the end of the day is an impact sport, and I'm fascinated by running because it's something that I used to like running quite a lot when I was younger, but I also was incredibly overweight when I was younger, so I was never a quick runner. I was more of a plod. But when I played rugby, it was, you know, you'd run around. Explosivity was really important in rugby. And then the only reason I stopped playing rugby was because of a knee injury, which is an injury which has plagued me on and off pretty much since then. Ironically, I think at the moment it's pretty good, but last year basically ended up writing off my whole year of stuff that I had planned. And I think people do often forget how much of an impact sport it is. Much more than people maybe understand. Like, you are continually pounding your joints a lot, you know, on concrete or whatever, which is tough. And admittedly, like, trainers are getting better and better every single month or whatever, but still, you're still going to be doing damage, surely.
Well, exactly. And this is the thing, is the sport of running. Or even if you call it like jogging, if someone says they're not a runner, but then you find out they run 5 days a week and they're like, yeah, but I just jog. It's like, yeah, but you run 5 days a week. You're a runner. You run one day a week, you're a runner. But as the sport has evolved and people have run faster and shoes have gotten better, and then you have, you know, GPS watches now, people are data driven. They want to run a certain pace, or they want to run, if some runners now are turning into like heart rate, similar to cycling. You find yourself running on asphalt or concrete or bike paths that are hard surfaces, and you can have the nicest, most up-to-date shoes.
Yeah.
But the best foams, and you're still compressing your body over and over again. And it's a strange evolution of the sport and the act of running and locomotion, if you will, that people have now become obsessed with times and distances, versus you'd actually probably be able to run further longer if you just went out to a forest and ran on dirt or bark chip or a trail, or like, maybe you won't run as fast, or there isn't a GPS, you know, the GPS signal stinks, but your knees will forgive you in 10 years time.
Surely, one, your knees will forgive you, and two, it's, I mean, my presumption would be it'd be way more enjoyable, you know.
Yeah, I guess it depends if like some real type A individuals that just can just do it every day, and those are incredible people.
It's interesting how, as you sort of mentioned it quite loosely, how data is becoming very something that's drive, it does drive cycling, and I have a love-hate relationship with it. But it's interesting. My dog, he's in his little crate.
Oh,
he's
fine.
He's got this bone. I'll show you.
This
bone. And he keeps out. He keeps playing with it and chucking it out and then having a little panic attack because it's then outside. Because I've shut him in there, so I know where he is. chucks it out and he's just like, shit, the bone's gone.
Yeah, he's like,
I can't do anything. My life is over. The bone's gone. I've got nothing to chew.
So close yet so far.
Yeah. It's interesting, as you say, like the data side of it. It's, as I said, I have a bit of a love-hate relationship with cycling. I really do understand the benefit of it, and it allows you to train smart. I could kind of understand that into an extent with running as well, like training to heart rate zones, etc. But it's something that's so easy to become obsessed with, and that mm-hmm. takes the pleasure out of a lot of sport, in my opinion.
No, I completely agree. I completely agree, and that was something that, you know, before I started cycling seriously, in sure, you know, I'm not doing races or whatever, and for everyone to give context, 2021, I cycled a fair amount, I would say. It was my first year of like actually training, even though I didn't race or like really do anything. I did 2 fondos just to be like, oh yeah, this is a lot. I don't really want to do a fondo ever again. Like those are shit. The Sunday warriors kind of scare me on descents. Like I have to go to work tomorrow. Like I don't really want to do this. I digress. But when I learned, because I transitioned from marathon racing and marathon training, that was like, you're going to go and you're going to do 18 miles at this pace and that's it. And you like, it wasn't heart rate, but it was like pace driven. Everything was focused for the, like 2 years prior, 3 years prior, when my life was running 26.2 miles, 42K at a pace that would qualify for a US Olympic trials. I was never going to make an Olympic team 10 minutes, 12 minutes off that. But that was like a huge thing. And then when I got into cycling, I've kind of digressed a little bit or regressed into it. It was more like, I just want to do as many kilometers a week in as fast as I can. Because that was just what I was doing with running. It was like, well, because again, it comes back to what I was saying earlier. It's a pounding sport, an impact sport. So if I can do that, if I can run just as far, but in 10 minutes less, why wouldn't I do that? Because then I'm have 10 minutes less pounding in my body. So it took some rewiring and literally like same, you know, we met on the Mallorca trip, but like, I'm not ashamed, like basically cold called, cold DM'd Ollie and was like, hey, I see you on my Explore feed. You cycle, you seem to have a history with training. How do I train? Do I go off of time? Do I go off? And he was like, time. It's all time. It's all time. And I was like, oh, this is incredible. And I think that's why I've fallen in this like passion in with cycling. So it's like, oh, I just go do 2 hours. And if the route's hilly, it will be shorter than if I'm just going to go do smash 2 hours on a flat island or something, you know? And running has just transitioned away from that. But I'll let you reply to that. And I've got a super cool running thing that I think that you would love after that.
The thing is with, you know, on the bike, volume is the key. Volume is the winner effectively. And then that's how you build up a good sort of level of base fitness, is just, you know, hours on the bike. But then the topping up and the, I think, refining whatever you want to refine, whether that's, you know, being more of a diesel engine, more of a sprinter, whatever, you know, better at doing like climbing, that's the topping up bit. And that's the bit where the more structured stuff does come in and become very useful. But literally, I mean, volume on the bike is the be all and end all. Like the more hours you can ride, I'm the biggest believer in riding slow and easy for a long time, because it makes you fit. Yeah. It is proven to make you fit. It's the same thing when you look at all these, you know, fitness things that tell you to go and get 6,000 steps a day just by walking, like go for a walk.
Yeah.
Walking is so, so good for you. And people, it's not hard. Like it's not a hard thing to do in the scale of the fitness world. Like it's much easier to go for a walk than it is to go for a run. But that just continual movement over, you know, if you're going for 2 hours, 3 hours, whatever it is incredibly good. If it's like slow and steady, like it just basically how I've been explained it by my coach is that if you're doing lots of slow and steady, it pushes everything up. So your top gets pushed up, your base gets pushed up, everything gets pushed up. While if you start doing like really hard stuff, your base is going to stay here. Then you're just going to have this big jump of randomness all going around. And I mean, my trip in Spain, just gone, my bike packing trip around Spain, Like, geez, it was just literally going and riding all day, basically, for 15 days. Like, they weren't massive distances, but there was a lot of climbing in some of the days. And not particularly riding hard, but riding on loaded bikes, which does make it different.
Seems hard, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, the last day we did, I very intentionally made it as hard as I could make it. So we, but instead of going from point A, which I can't remember it was, to Alicante, which was 60K straight, 50-60K straight, pretty easy. I decided to make it 110K and basically snake around the mountain range there. Found one climb that was 4 kilometers long, 20%. Yeah.
It's a really long time.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would, I don't know if I would talk to you maybe for the rest of the ride, Chris.
Yeah.
I found out if I didn't know that you did that and then I rolled up, I'd be like, All right, I have to do this. Like, I can't really, like, what am I going to, like, turn, like, I don't know. I, at this point, my energy is so depleted after days of riding. Like, I'm not going to reroute myself. So I guess this is it. But
well, the reason was we had originally planned to ride up to Valencia and then back down the coast. But then the weather forecast towards Valencia was really bad. So we cut it short. And I was like, fuck it. I'm going to make it really hard because the next day the weather was really bad. I knew we weren't going to go and do any riding, so we'd just chill out. And basically, I say it's 20% over 4K, but it was pretty much 20% over 4K, and in the middle of it was a flat bit. So the average gradient was classed as being, I think, 11 or 12% because of the flat bit.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I was leaning right over the front of the bike to keep the front of the bike down. You know, we both were regularly looking down and seeing numbers well over like 400 plus watts and just thinking, yeah, this sucks. Dripping with sweat in the distance.
Yeah, yeah.
And I see a man in the distance going up it on an e-bike and I'm like, I'm catching you. Like, he was he got up it, he was struggling, but he got up it. And I got up to him, caught him, got to the top, my heart rate's going up through the roof, and just thinking, oh, maybe I shouldn't have planned that one in. But I, when we got there, I was kind of in the mentality, like, I'm never going to do this climb again. So I'm going to try and enjoy it. And you're going up it, and it's been used in La Vuelta several times. And you're going up it, and there's, like, names of riders written on the road, really standard in Spain. There's also skull and crossbones drawn on the road. And then the percentage written next to it. And I was just like, you're looking down at it, where the sweat's dripping down, like, oh my God.
Yeah, that's a bad sign. Oh, man. So there's this thing, this is it's not really a story, but, you know, when we talk about cycling and running, Chris, and Imperfect, you know, you're doing the climb, you're seeing like high power, high heart rate and stuff. So there's this coach who is a Nike professional coach now, Jerry Schumacher. He used to be the coach at, is a distance running coach on the track and then up to the marathon. And he used to be the head cross country coach and distance coach at University of Wisconsin, Madison, in the early 2000s, and definitely known probably globally, not within the running world, definitely known, regarded as probably one of the greatest distance running coaches ever, definitely in like practicing, if you will, now. And he has this thing called Badger Miles, the University of Wisconsin Madison. They're the Badgers, that's their mascot. And Jerry, for the longest time, he refused to let his athletes use a GPS watch until recently. And it was kind of one of those things like, you can only hold them back. It's like 2021. Like, it's, I don't know where you can find a Timex Ironman watch. And like, it's just not worth it, whatever. And he had this thing called Badger Miles, where it was no matter what you do, you log it as if it is a 7 minute mile. 70 minutes is 10 miles in the log. Could be faster, could be slower, but it takes the mind out. You go do a 70 minute loop, you write it in your log, it's 10 miles. Women, I think it was like eight minutes. But yeah, so then he still does it, and it's not as strict anymore, but I know a lot of these athletes. I ran university with them. He's based out of Portland now too. So the group. So, you know, I ran with them and know them really well, and they're phenomenal people. They have their log is on Google Drive or sheet, and they have, you know, the day with the workout, and then they have a line that says time that you ran.
Yeah.
Jerry miles is what they call it, or Badger miles, and then actual miles. And then it tallies up. And like, sometimes you'll have these like major extreme deviations of like 25 miles difference. Wow. Between, which is a significant number. If you're doing 120 miles in a week, you're like, oh,
yeah.
I'm really tired this week.
This is like, why.
Because you ran too hard. But I like, the reason that I'm saying that is once, I mean, you hinted, or you didn't hint, but you said volume is king. Load is king in cycling, or king or queen. And like, you have, that's the closest thing in running that exists, to be honest. Is the Jerry, the Badger miles. But everyone else is like, oh yeah, my GPS watch, I'm like circling around the parking lot, got to get 10 miles, 9.8 doesn't count, I'm just gonna like run around the parking lot a little bit. You're like, this, runners are lunatics, Chris. Like, the
cyclists,
new age,
do that as GPS. Well, cyclists do that as well.
Really?
Yeah. Like, you've got like someone, if you say went out, I know many riders that do it, where they're like, oh, I've done, you know, 29.8 kilometers. They'll intentionally make it 30. I think that's part, one of the problems with having technology and tracking stuff all the time. Like, I actually quite enjoy it when I go for a ride and it is slightly short, because I know there's people who will see it on Strava or Komoot or whatever, and they'll be like, why don't you just ride up a little bit more? And I'm like, well, I didn't need to. I've done my ride. Doesn't matter.
Yeah. It doesn't matter. There's a marathoner, Scott Faubel, phenomenal. He got seventh place at Boston Marathon 2 years ago. American kid. He's my age. He's notorious for running like 99.8 miles in a week and posting it on Twitter and posting it on Strava, because all of his stuff's uploaded to Strava. And he'll be like, yeah, you better believe I'm sitting on the couch not doing shit. Go run to my mailbox and back. Who cares? Like, what is a 2.2 ever going to – like, if I get to a race and I finish the race and I could pinpoint that though that little difference made the difference, then I've done something drastically wrong in the rest of my training.
Yeah.
Like, it's exactly. Like, it's not like that. But it's good to know that there are cyclists that do that. It's bad to know, I'll be honest, but it's good to know that they're not too indifferent, because it really doesn't matter, in my opinion. And that's why, like I said, I've become super passionate in this relationship with running. Now, again, is because of finding cycling and being like, I'm just gonna go ride for 2 hours, I'm gonna go ride for 90 minutes, and I don't really know enough about cycling to know what the numbers are, and I'm totally fine with that.
It doesn't matter.
And now I'm like, I'm just gonna go run for 70 minutes, and I might bring my Garmin, might wear my Apple Watch, might not wear a watch, and I know this loop is like 70 minutes. I think it's fine.
It doesn't, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. That is that simple. It just doesn't matter, in really, unless you're performing at the very, very top end of the sport, you know, where marginal gains, where you're, you know, restricting what you're eating, all that kind of stuff, where you've got someone that looks after your bike for you the whole time. It doesn't matter. For most people, it really doesn't matter. Like, you can get away with so much just by going down the basis of volume, you know, hours, whatever it is. And like, I'm such a believer in that. But equally, both you and I, a big Zwifters.
Yes.
In contrast.
Love it.
And I think
I think
for both of us, there's a similar mentality of it. And one is because turbo training makes you fucking strong. No denying it. Structured training like that on a turbo makes you strong, because you're following a plan and you don't get the opportunity to freewheel. So it's very, very time efficient. So how I always think about it is, if I've got a training session, which I choose to do indoors, anything that's very structured, I'll always do it indoors because it's time efficient, it's easy. But if I was to do the equivalent outside, I'd probably need to add on an hour to be able to do the structure of it, because you're not going to build up the same sort of TSS as you would indoors. But there's so many people, there's so many like turbo haters out there, but I fucking love it. It's a great addition to the sport. I like that there's, you know, racing. I like that there's an e-world championship. I just think, you know, why not? It's very accessible to a lot of people, and I quite like that.
I think it's incredible. I think people that are haters, and I know that they exist, have lost the plot, Chris.
Yeah.
I think it's incredible. I think it's absolutely incredible. Like, it's the most efficient thing in the world. And it's not to say, you know, if it's good weather, I'm not going to go outside if it's just an easy ride. But like I've told you, like, you know, thankfully I'm in an enclosed room in my work office right now, but like I will 100% take work meetings on a 2-hour easy ride on the Zwift. Can't do that outside, because then like I can't unmute, like pull my phone out, unmute, they hear the wind, like be like, and now people are like, oh yeah, you're on the bike, yeah sure,
it doesn't matter.
I have coworkers that have Zwift and they just check if I'm on Zwift before they try to ask if I'm a meeting. They go on Zwift Companions, see how Nick Roche's on Watopia, I guess I'll set up a meeting in an hour with him. But yeah, no, I think racing, it's what I'll say is, as someone, and I'm only speaking as someone that is, I will say, and I believe it, new to the sport of cycling. Zwift is so easy to get into the sport of cycling, because you don't need it. Like, you just need a bike that you can put on a trainer. That's all you need. You need, and so the overall investment is so, like, so little compared to getting a nice bike to go do the same thing outside, right? And me, it was like, Chris, when I started, I was doing like 3-4 races a week. And it was totally the stupidest thing in the world. But I was like, this is great. Yeah. I'm like racing. I'm seeing, like, I beat that person. Sick. This is great. I just get like so hyped.
Yeah, you get, it's nice because you get that competitive buzz from it quite easily as well.
And there's a race every 15 minutes, 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
And it's incredible. And it's incredible. And like, yeah, with the E and everything. And then it was, for me, you know, I was doing, I think last year I did 2 Zwift plans, just again to like understand what training is. And it was a lot, but it was like, oh, this is like kind of cool. Like, I kind of like working out and seeing these numbers. I still, to say, like I said earlier, like, I don't fully understand what they mean, but now I've kind of, I have my bearings, at least they exist, on what hard power is, what hard heart rate is, you know, and what easy is and what easy is. And yeah, that's what, I mean, Zwift has done that. And for me, it makes no sense. I have no idea how I would do these sessions outdoors, Chris.
Yeah.
Speaking very open, honestly.
The big thing for me is, like, I do most of my indoor, in fact, I say most of it, pretty much all of my indoor stuff is done on a time trial bike, because time in the position on a TT bike, where I live is hilly, and I've got very big chain rings on that bike. So you're not getting up some of the hills with it.
Yeah.
And I personally think riding a time trial bike in the UK outside can be very easily quite dangerous unless you're racing. Just because of the nature of traffic and stuff, you know, we've seen it, you know, recently with Egan Bernal with his accident, with Chris Froome with his accident, both of them happened on TT bikes, you know, potentially life-changing injuries to both of them, you know, and they are incredible machines, that incredibly fast, super slick, super well designed, but my God, if you're not looking, it's scary as fuck. And I hate this whole thing of the current, like, TT, young TT riders, it tends to be not being able to see when they're racing. And in the UK, we have British Cycling, but we also have a separate body which governs TTs called CTT. And the time trials are run by CTT. You don't have to follow the UCI rules for your TT bike. So you can actually make your bikes even more aero. There's no limitations like there is for UCI races, unless you do a UCI-led time trial, which there aren't actually that many in the UK. So people just go all out with like their TT bikes and make them crazy aero. But the problem with that is you get this whole thing about vision and not being able to see when you're racing, when people are putting their heads down and basically looking at the line on the road, and it's fucking dangerous. And you know, I've wind tunnel tested my time trial position. I've tested my time trial position a lot. I know my CDA. I know how fast I am. I know how like slippery my position is. And my position is the same position for a 10-mile time trial as it is for a 24-hour time trial, and it's fucking fast. And I can see fantastically well. So this bollocks about needing to like tuck, you know, yes, you do shrug your shoulders down, but this bollocks about not looking is bollocks. It's bollocks. Like, you can get fast enough with your vision still in place. So that is, I've got an event here. That is why I time trial train on a TT bike indoors, because I don't feel comfortable enough doing it on open roads all the time here. I just think we don't have the infrastructure for it. Like, if there was places where I'd be like, like in London, surprisingly enough, random reference, but like Richmond Park and Regent's Park are quite good for time trial training because it's a park, but you don't have a lot of those kind of places in other parts of the UK. I now live in the Peak District where there is a massive national park, but it's completely open to cars and traffic, you know. And you go to Richmond Park really early in the morning, it's closed. I mean, I'm talking before 7 o'clock. The gates are closed.
Yeah.
So you could go there for 6 o'clock, do an hour's training on a TT bike on a closed circuit with amazing, you know, amazing road surface, and then just roll home quite slowly and casually, you know, sitting upright. And you've got an hour in on TT bike. But, you know, here, efficiency indoors on a time trial bike, the best thing to do to get time in that position is just to do it indoors on a turbo trainer.
No,
it's proper steady state riding. You don't need to be getting out the saddle or anything on a time trial bike. You're supposed to be staying in that stationary position, and a turbo is so good for that.
I have to admit, time trial bikes scare the heck out of me. Like, I don't even like descending in the drops, Chris. I'm a complete like dork when it comes to, as you saw, I've gotten way better. And I know people that rode with me this time last year in Germany and then have ridden with me recently. And they're like, oh yeah, you're way better. Mm. But I'm still like, don't love it. I don't know, just because I haven't done it enough to do it. So I can't imagine like young riders, like what you're saying, like fairly, you know, not super tapped in, but up to date on cycling and things. And you have these like mega young riders doing TT stuff. I'm like, I don't know if you have, I don't know you well enough to know this, but I don't know if you've done enough riding to be like totally locked in to not be looking at where you're going on a TT bike.
Yeah.
Like, that's just for me as someone that like, I haven't done it, so I'm not even comfortable riding in the drops. And I rode, you know, for normal person, like I rode 15,000 kilometers last year between indoor and outdoor. Like that's, I feel like a decent amount for someone that doesn't race and doesn't have a background in sport. And I don't feel comfortable. And that's where I'm like, ooh, that scares me. But again, maybe I'm a dork.
I mean, it has definitely changed, and the advancements in, you know, I'm a huge believer in disc brakes. The advancements in disc brake technology has really changed things for time trialing as well as road cycling. It's allowed for, you know, wider rims, therefore wider tires, better comfort. Like there's so many positives to it. It tests, generally speaking, on a lot of TT bikes that are now disc brake actually test faster than the rim brake versions. But the big benefit of it is time trial bikes, when they were rim brake ones, quite often, you know, you're trying to integrate and hide the brakes somewhere
in the frame,
and those brakes are just so bad. And before, I've got a Cervelo P series now, which is disc brake time trial bike. It's a fantastic bike. Before that, I had a Giant Trinity, which also great time trial bike. For the cost of the frame set, it's probably one of the fastest bikes you could buy. It's a great frame, but my God, the brakes are the shittest brakes I've ever had. And I was finding that I was slower in TTs on it because I was braking so much more in advance going up to roundabouts or corners because I was having to scrub the speed. While in contrast on the Cervelo, I used it last year quite a lot for racing, and you know, bad weather, whatever it was, it's like disc brakes, they stop. And the amount of time, the stoppage time, instead of being 30 seconds, is five seconds, you know, if that. And I remember going to I did a TT near here. It was I think it was a 20-mile one, 20, 25. Mm-hmm. I can't really remember the distance, but it was somewhere near me. And it was biblical weather. And Dame Sarah Story was on the start line. So it was cool, really cool. Because she's unbelievably strong. And I was I know her husband Barney quite well, and I know her a little bit. So I was chatting to Barney at the end, and I beat Sarah by, I think it was 5 seconds, which for me, I was like, that's amazing. I'll take that.
Yes.
And Barney was like, he said to me at the end, he's like, the reason why he thinks Sarah was slower, she won the women's, but was like, I think she was sixth overall still. And won the women's by quite a lot. And he was like, the reason why she was slower than she'd normally be on a course like this is because she's on a rim brake bike and she's hesitant on the turns and stuff. And he is like, and the problem is for Sarah, there's not for her specifically, because all her braking is done with her right hand. There's not been the advancement in how you would work the hydraulic brakes to be controlled at the same time with her right hand. So it's because it's quite confusing. That's why she's on a break time trial bike still. But you know, there's definitely advancements that we're seeing that disc brakes are really helping confidence with descending as well. Like the difference of having disc brakes for descending as opposed to rim brakes is insane. I remember doing the Singlet Ventoux, which is the three ways up and down Mont Ventoux. Mm-hmm. I did it on my S5 rim brake with 80 mil tires, with 80 mil rims on it, which was just bonkers anyway. Really? And I remember one of the descents, I can't remember which one, but going down it and thinking, I don't know, this is going to stop around this corner. Literally.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm doing 90 kph right now. I don't know if I'm going to stop on the next corner. I'm going to start braking now and hope. And that sound of carbon squeaking is horrible as well. It's horrible.
Oh man, yeah, no, it's oof. Chris, I have a question for you.
Go on.
What would you say to someone like myself that might be listening to this that is done, you know, again, a year, 18 months, let's call it like relatively new to the sport, but is looking to learn more about the sport, be that training, gear, whatever. Yeah. We'll just kind of throw it under the umbrella of learn more about the sport. What resources would you say they should utilize? Could be a website, could be someone's social media, could be a podcast, could be a magazine, whatever. Yeah. What would you say would be like the top 3 to 5 resources? Because that's what something that coming into this chat here, I want to put myself in the shoes of me if I wasn't the guest on this. What would I be like, okay, this is a takeaway that I'm stoked and now I can utilize to learn more about the sport.
I'm going to go down the route of 5 training resources.
Yep.
Because I think I could do 5 and I like doing things in 5 because it only means that the last ones are really, really good. So the first one that instantly comes to my head is the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast, which is done by Trainer Road. It's the guys that run it is a guy called there's I think 4 people that do it now actually, and then the main guy is called Jonathan who hosts it, and then the guy that funded Trainer Rose, Nate, is on it and he's quite funny, but they basically take loads of questions and it obviously has some relation to Trainer Road and the program that they run, but generally it's a very good podcast for just general training advice and information. It's on all the podcast subscribers and they also video it and put it on YouTube. So the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast is definitely the number one one I'd always go to because I listen to that one when I'm riding quite a lot. I think it's really interesting. Second one for training, like what you're already doing by using something like Zwift and doing Zwift training plans is a really, really good introduction because there'll be people who are like a year, 2 years into cycling who still maybe don't understand that side of it. But using something like Zwift for their training plans, Trainer Road, whatever it is, using one of those pre-done training plans gives you a really good understanding or start of an introduction into the training side with structured training. The next step from that logically is looking at working with a cycling coach. Mm-hmm. Now, there's freaking hundreds of people who say they're cycling coaches out there. The bit that's more tricky is finding one that you think is genuinely good and one that actually you get on with really well. So my coach is my mate, and has been my mate for years. He's called Ken. And I first met Ken when the first time I wanted to do any kind of like cycling challenge. It's very early on into me riding. And basically, I can't remember how we got in touch, but we got chatting and just got on really well. And I turned around to him and said, right, I want to ride around Richmond Park for 24 hours. Yeah, at the time, I don't think it had been done before. This is 2014, maybe? I'm not sure. Uh-huh. Maybe a bit later than that. 2014, 2015? I didn't think it had been done before. I was like, I want to do it for 24 hours and I want to fundraise for PACE, which is the children's school that I work with. Mm-hmm. And the Ken basically was like, yep, cool. Right. We're going to do a ramp test to see where your fitness is at. We're going to do, take the blood oxygen as well, which is little pricks in the earlobe.
Yeah.
And it gives you a really good understanding of where your base point is and then how to build from that. So working with a coach, as I say, the tricky thing is finding a coach that one, you get on with, and two, that is good and has some serious credentials to it. The reason why I think Ken is good, for example, is one, he's quite highly qualified. Two, he's raced at the top level, so he gets it. Mm-hmm. And three, because he's a mate of mine and I'm very much, in his own words, an anomaly to the kind of people he coaches. He coaches lots of racers. He's very invested in working out what the best way to train me is for what I do, because it's
quite an athlete.
It's great. There's a really good relationship there. So I've got, what have I got here? I've got coach, the Zwift or something similar, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast. And then I'm going to go down the route. I'm looking for audiobooks in my thing, because I listen to loads of audiobooks. I'm quite dyslexic, so audiobooks are a really good way for me to pretend that I'm intelligent.
digest books.
Yeah, and it's a great thing to do when you're riding. It's a really good thing to do when you're riding. Like, audiobooks are easy, and I'm going to suggest several here that I would really recommend people look at. Reading or listening, it's kind of take it in your own state or whatever. I'm going to go from the bottom of my list here. Where are we? There's one. It's not this. What these are? Some of these are very cycling related. Some of them are not so cycling related. So it's quite an interesting mix. Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker, which is a book about sleep and recovery and the process of recovery. It's really interesting. I didn't think it was going to be interesting, but actually I'm not a good sleeper. So for me, understanding how I can improve my sleeping processes really helped me for races and stuff like that. The Mindful Athlete, which is by George Mumford, is another example of a book which talks about...
I've read that.
Yeah, great book. You know that one.
So good.
Yeah, it's a really, really good one. I'd highly recommend that one. How Bad Do You Want It by Matt Fitzgerald. That's another really good one, which talks about, well, quite literally, your desire to complete different things. And then Endure, which is by Alex Hutchinson, is another good one. And then on a slightly different note, these are more autobiographical, but still very interesting. I'm just basically going through my list here. There's a book called The Line, which is by Dr. Richard Freeman, who is the doctor that has been in quite a lot of trouble with Team Sky, mysterious packages. It's a really interesting book because it does talk a lot about the training and the process of training and having a doctor in a professional team. David Miller's book, The Racer, is another really interesting one. Very similar, talks about him as a time trialist. Like, David Miller, you know, came out as and openly admitted that he doped and was banned, and then came back when he was racing for Garmin Sharp as kind of like some sort of resurgence of his career thing. It's a really interesting book, hearing his stance on a lot of that. The Chimp Paradox by Steve Peters. Steve Peters is a very well-known doctor, but worked specifically with British Cycling and Team Sky when they started. And the whole Chimp Paradox is all about, impulse and controlling the impulse of your brain, and understanding that emotions are great, but also can really fuck up your opportunities for doing stuff. If you hear about Steve Peters and Chris Hoy and Victoria Pendleton, huge advocates of him and what he's done, and they put a lot of their success at the Olympics down to Steve Peters. And same with like some of the early, it's a great, really good book, really interesting. It doesn't talk so much about it in the terms of cycling, more general, but it's a very interesting one, because I really do think that on the training side of it, your mind is as important as your physical body. It's so well interconnected. So, and I'm a big believer of that kind of thing. Now, as an inspirational book, which I listen to get me hyped, is David Goggins' You Can't Hurt Me. Yeah. If you don't know David Goggins, just check him out on social media. If you're not hyped by listening to him talking, I don't know who you are.
His Instagram's nuts.
Yeah.
It's nuts. What's so good? Run through a brick wall.
Yeah, he's just hardcore. But what's so good about specifically his audio book, in my opinion, is that it's narrated, or it's read by another guy, and then at the start of every chapter, it's a conversation with David Goggins and the guy that reads the book. So you've got the chapter and then a conversation, chapter conversation. So it becomes quite almost a bit podcasty. So like the guy that's narrating the book he'll have read the chapter, and then he'll just be like, what the fuck just happened in that chapter? And then David Goggins will go into a bit more depth about it. So it's quite an interesting way of doing it.
Yeah.
And then I'm trying to think of other ones that really stand out to me that have been good ones to listen to.
Keep going.
I was going to say Mark Beaumont's Around the World in 80 Days is a fantastic one, because it's endurance cyclists there and then. And also Mark Cavendish and Geraint Thomas's books, there's several, because they talk about the British cycling training, you know, winning the stages at the Tour de France and the training aspect of it. And Cav's one's really nice because it also covers, you know, his mental health. He really struggles with depression. And he covers quite a lot of that in his book. And similarly, Geraint Thomas's one talks very much about the fact that he maybe never should have actually won the Tour de France, and much more open and honest about his situation and how he was. So they're ones I'd really recommend. There is tons of really, really good books about training and mental health out there. And the other thing to start thinking about, in my opinion, with training is nutrition and what you're eating, whether that's on the bike and off the bike. My mate Will, who is the nutritionist for EF, and my other mate Owen, who is a chef for EF, put tons of really, really good stuff out there on their social media accounts, and also on their, Will's got his own website, which has tons of recipes on it, and they also regularly write like blog posts for EF, so there's some really good resources there as well. Yeah, that's probably more.
No, that's really cool. To go one step backwards on your books, Chris, if I could suggest one for you it's got to have an audiobook. It's called Marathon Man by Bill Rogers. And so Bill Rogers, self-explanatory, was a marathoner, is a marathoner, American marathoner. And it's more or less a autobiography. Bill Rogers is well known as one of the greatest marathoners ever in existence. He won the Boston Marathon 4 times, New York City 4 times, Fukuoka, which is like the marathon, which actually just was ended, one win there. But it's his life in this, in how he first saw the Boston Marathon. I might be getting this a little bit wrong, but like, I think he was still drunk after work. He was working a night shift and he was living in Boston at the time. and saw, it was like still up, and saw the marathoners go by, and he was like, that's the craziest thing I've ever seen. And then he went on to win the Boston Marathon.
Amazing.
Four times, in New York four times. And the book's just like how someone, and it's, and I think it's, maybe it's, I find it similar, and I hope that, you know, if you can find it on audiobook and listen to it, similar to like my career in cycling of like, I just thought it was really sick, and I saw it and I was like, what's that about? And then I started doing it. Obviously I'm not going to go win the tour four times or something, you know, of relation to that, but like, that's how I found the sport.
Yeah.
And how you can just still have success. You don't have to be, you know, born and raised a cyclist or born and raised a runner to find success, which is all relative anyway, in the sport. And this book definitely reminded me. And I read it a couple times a year, and it's like pretty sick. So yeah, I would suggest that if you get time and can find it on audio.
I'll add it onto my list. Sure. It's one of those, there are always those books, aren't there, that you end up going back to several times and you relate to. And for me, probably on the similar scale, it's David Goggins' one. And Cavendish's first one at speed.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and it is because that I, you know, I'm part Manx, so I'm already a bit biased to Mark Cavendish anyway. But
sure.
It's his openness to talk about things outside of cycling is what I find really relatable. And also how at the end of it, he's just like, you know, I'm not going to be, this book came out in 2013. So it's quite an old book.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And he's got a new one that's, I think it's out now, but the audiobook hasn't been recorded yet. But he's like, I know that I'm not going to be the fastest guy forever. I know I'm not going to be the quickest sprinter. And at the end of 2013, it was the year that Marcel Kittel was like beating him in sprints at the Tour de France. It's the first time he lost on the Champs-Élysées in the Tour de France in his whole career. So it was like quite big. And he's like, he's talking about it. Like, I know I'm not going to be, you know, this, and my career is going to end at some point. And he's like, he basically ends it by saying like, all I care about is that at the end of the day, when I've retired and everything like that, that I'm known as being a good bike rider, but more importantly, being a family man. And I was like,
oh, super cool.
That's it.
That's super cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Yeah. Showing a human element. A lot of individuals, I've done it, you know, but you start to view athletes and professional athletes even more specifically as not human.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, oh, you know, we're talking about cycling here. You start to view people in the peloton is like not actually a human.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, oh yeah, you're just really good at playing bikes.
Yeah.
But actually, like, I have emotion. I care about things outside of riding the bike, even though I'm really, really good at it.
You know, there's this element that there's with all sports, you know, there's people that are going to be at the top tier of their sport and their industry, whatever it is. But at the end of the day, they are only human. There's so much that can go to help and enhance someone. And there's what I think, you know, people maybe don't realize is the sacrifices that these top end athletes have to make to be at that position. Like Bradley Wiggins, the year that he won the Tour de France, well, take away 2012, 2011, he was living like a monk, you know.
Yeah.
And he crashed out of the Tour de France in 2011, you know, and all that hard work and prep had gone. So you think 2010, 2011, he's living like a monk to try and win the Tour de France. And then he crashes out of the Tour de France in 2011 and then has to continue doing it for 2012, which is, and then the funny thing is like after he won the Tour, being the, you know, the first Brit to win it, which is also debatable because Chris Froome came second in 2011, but then got promoted to winning it because of, I can't remember who won it, was banned for doping. But, so there's loads of, oh no, was that the Tour or was it the Vuelta? Bradley Wiggins' was the first Tour, Chris Froome would be the first Grand Tour Brit, and it was the Vuelta.
Yeah, Grand Tour, yeah.
So like, there's tons of questions about like, you know, with Bradley Wiggins, it's like, he won the Tour, he then goes and wins the time trial at the London Olympics, and then has a massive blowout. And it's because he's lived like a monk for 3 years, basically, and has been on the
reached his breaking point.
Yeah, and like, it's completely understandable. Like, we're all human at the end of the day. Like most, for example, like last, like I, you know, I'm pretty committed to training and diet and stuff like that. And a big reason why I am is because I'm not someone that is blessed with the best genetics when it comes to weight, shall we say. You know, I come from a lot of people in my family are large. And also my, you know, my mum has had very quite severe battles with eating disorders and alcohol. And so the food is a very tricky thing in my family. Always has been.
Yeah, sure.
Whether it's too much, too little, like there's always been a tricky thing. So I'm, you know, I'm very conscious of that. And last year, because of the continual injury issues I had, I just went, fuck it, I'm just gonna do what I want. And for me, that I needed to do that for a year, because it's like, well, I can't really ride to what would be my optimum because I'm, I was injured for 6 months of last year, 6-7 months on and off. Yeah. So I'm just gonna relax and take the time off and enjoy it. But the good thing about that is it's meant that I can now become I'm way more focused this year than I have been in years.
Yeah, which is super cool.
Yeah, and you need to have that balance. You really do. It's so important. And at the end of the day, we're just riding big kids' toys. That's what we're doing.
Exactly.
You know, exactly. Just having fun riding kids' toys. Like, come on. It's that simple. It is that simple.
I couldn't agree more. No, yeah. It's easy.
Yeah.
No, this is great, Chris. I really appreciate the opportunity to come and chat, even though, you know, you've probably had and will have after me much more experienced cyclists and individuals, but the opportunity to come in.
The thing is,
you know, kick the can. If you will,
for me with the and I'm sure many people will know with how the podcast has gone, I can't even think how many episodes. I think this is episode number 69, I think.
Whoa,
big number that. I think it's 69, I can't remember, but for me it's always been, people who've listened to this will know that generally I just like to do podcasts with people I find interesting or things that I find interesting. Mm-hmm. And what's so interesting about you is there's several strings to your bow, let's say.
Sure.
First of all, there's the string of your running history. Secondly, there's a string of how you've come into cycling and your interest in the sport and being someone who is, you know, no denying it, and you've openly admitted it, quite a new cyclist, but is coming into cycling at already a very strong level because of your background. And then thirdly, you work for a pretty cool company, which I'm quite happy to name drop it. And you know, you work for Adidas, and you say it much better than me because you've got a great accent.
I work at Adidas.
See?
Adidas, yeah.
It sounds better.
It's my German accent. It's my German accent, you know.
Equally, one of the things that really struck me when we were chatting is your care for detail. And when we were riding, I was and I still do have a lot of issues with shoes. We're very open about that. And you spent a lot of time with me trying to figure out a solution and introducing me to a very nice man. Who's also been trying to figure out and help with the solutions to solving my problem with my feet. And that is the kind of person that you are, is that you're very generous with support and knowledge and information. And I'm very thankful.
Yeah. Basically. Wow. I really appreciate that. Very kind. I think that's something that it's good to hear, because that's something that I do make an effort, an honest effort to do on a daily occurrence. What Cass, my wife, that was on the trip as well, likes to call me is a connector of dots. If I don't have the answer, or if I can't tell you something, you better believe if I know someone that can help you or that can get you the answer, I will 100% connect with them, whether you want it, ask for it, want it, or whatever. Like again, so, you know, we're shooting the shit on a ride about the issues and the trials that you've gone through with footwear on the bike. I was like, oh, like maybe about this. And then I'm like racking my brain for the next 30 minutes. And then I get back and I'm like, well, one of my old coworkers at Audi now, you know, makes shoes for Specialized. I'll just ping you his contact and him yours and you guys. And then like later, it was 4 hours later, Tom's like, Chris, this is epic. And then you're like, great. And like, and that's what I love doing is just connecting people. If I can't help, I want to try my best to find someone that can help out, especially, you know, things that obviously you deal with, but like your footwear, but it could be like the smallest thing. Like, hey, I'm coming to Berlin for the weekend. I don't live in Berlin, but if I could, if I know someone in Berlin that wants to go for a ride, I'll connect you to via social media or something. Be like, hey, you guys are my mates. Let's, you guys should link up for a ride. You guys are both nice people, stuff like that. It I get joy out of that, which is very weird. I think.
No, I get it.
I don't think it's weird.
I don't think it's weird. There's something very, there's something very heartwarming about the simplicity of wanting to join the dots and help people out. And it's really refreshing because I don't think there's enough people in society who really, first of all, do that. And secondly, see the value in it because it's very valuable. And like, I think one of the things when I was, there's a couple of things that are drilled into me as a kid and I hope, and I feel that they've helped me as a, as I've become a man. And one of those things was my dad always said to me, treat others how you want to be treated yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, and what that eventually translated to as he got older was don't be a fucking dick.
Yeah, sure.
Very blunt about it. My dad's quite Northern. He's quite blunt about those kind of things. And also similarly is that whole thing of if you, if someone gives you the time of day, you give them the time of day back. So an example of that, it to me, if someone messages me asking a question about something, I might not reply straight away because I might be busy, but I will reply at some point.
Yeah.
Within a relatively close proximity of time and answer to whatever it is to the best of my ability. Because the hope is that then that flips back on and at a point when you need that support, that it will come back around to you. And then the last bit of advice I was always given, which wasn't by my dad, but was by like a mentor to me who still is a mentor, is my old lecturer when I was at university. He's a guy called, he's a guy called Leighton Reed, and he's a very respected architect in London, in the UK, older guy. He'll hate me for saying he's an older guy. he listens to the podcast as well. So sorry. But, you know, he came from a quite a tough background. He was one of the first black architects of his generation, had to deal with a lot of racial abuse for being black in a predominantly white male industry and still is, to be honest, a predominantly white male industry. And made a real point of, you know, being fucking badass at his job and an amazing designer and architect. Yeah. And one of the best bit of advice he always gave me was look up, just that. And he meant that in the context of like, in several different ways. And one is when you're walking around, look up and see what's around you, because you're looking at the floor, you can miss some of the best things. But also he meant it in the context of like, you should always look up to people as if you were when you're a kid and you look up to your mum and dad and you're looking up to them, because you always should see the best in someone before you see the worst of them and never see the negative side until you've been given a reason to see it and understand it. And like that, that those sort of little things have been things that have stuck with me for years, absolutely years. And I think that there's maybe, you know, some people could say, oh, there's an element of naivety in that. But I think actually there's nothing wrong with naivety. It's actually probably one of the best traits in human beings is to be naive. Yeah. And that's how you can do stupid things and stupid challenges or whatever it is, because you go into it completely naive and blind. And then you might suddenly regret it, but that's fine. That's fine. Nothing wrong with regretting something halfway through it.
Yeah, if you try it. No, absolutely. Absolutely. The last thing that I'll say, Chris, and I have to jump off to a meeting. One would be, I appreciate the opportunity, like I said, to hop on this and share whatever I could possibly can. And just kind of, like I said earlier, kick the can with you on this. This is great. To anyone listening to this, watching it, whatever you're doing, take the chance to send that message to someone if you're new to the sport. I've, to Chris's point, like, there are a lot of people that won't respond.
Yeah.
Tons of them in life, sport, whatever. But Chris has responded. And then obviously after, met you on the trip, but now I'm on a podcast with you talking about life, trying to inspire other people, trying to be relatable. And all that was a text message, was an Instagram DM. And the things you can do, what's the worst that happens? Chris doesn't respond. Okay, my life is still the same that it was, barring, an actual life-threatening situation. Please don't DM me on a life-threatening, just call me or something. But, what I'm saying is, like, just take the chance, shoot the text. Everyone, it's your thing. Like, look up to people, but also we're all human. We're all, like, we've all been there before. We were all rookies. We were all new in whatever we're pursuing in life. And if someone doesn't take the time, then that's probably okay. Maybe you didn't want to talk to them anyway.
So exactly.
That's what I would say.
That's a really good way to end it. And I'm gonna stop recording there, I reckon.